And I ended up getting a job at Lehman Brothers, and I really didn't know what investment banking was, to be honest. At the time, I was doing a comedy show on the college radio station. So they said, "Well, we see that you do a comedy show. Why don't you tell us a joke?" And then I did an imitation of Jimmy Stewart advocating for the use of crack. And they, I guess, thought it was funny. And for some reason, that translated into me being qualified to be an investment banker.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. John Hlinko is a political activist and entrepreneur who's built the online group called Left Action, which he characterizes as millions of progressive activists fighting back against right-wing extremism. It's a big email list and Facebook group. John's been around progressive activism for a lot of the last 30 years, and Left Action's been going for about a decade now. If you get to know John, you find out that he's a character, someone who's always looking to bring humor to his work, which has ranged from digital activism to running enterprises. He's combined a master's in public policy at the Kennedy School with the title Buzz Czar. So we had an enjoyable conversation ranging from his time working to draft General Wesley Clark for president in 2003, to running grassroots enterprise, to Left Action, and his advice for creating engagement online. So first to our sponsor, then my interview with John Hlinko at Left Action.
The way political campaigns are engaging with voters is changing, and DS Political is here to help. Without live events and door-to-door canvassing, campaigns have to get creative. DS Political matches offline voter data to online profiles with match rates up to 90%, allowing you to target your voters with precision. We pioneered the best integration of data and technology to persuade audiences and deliver wins for progressive candidates and causes with efficient and effective programmatic digital advertising campaigns. Learn more at dspolitical.com/battlefield.
So, John, how are you today?
Doing well. Quarantine, but otherwise doing not so bad.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is John Hlinko. I'm the head of Left Action, an activist community for progressives and Democrats. It's been around for about 10 years. I've been working in some form in progressive activism for most of the last, I guess 30 years at this point, usually with an online focus and often trying to use humor to the extent possible to try and get people engaged at the grassroots level.
How big of an activist community is Left Action?
Well, the total list between email and Facebook's about 2.5 million, but I would say, you know, really about a third to a quarter of those are aggressively active, or I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but are regularly active. A lot of people just sort of, you know, dip their toes in once in a while, but it's pretty sizable considering it's, you know, started from, well, pretty much just me. So
what does that mean, community? What do people who are part of Left Action do?
The place where you find them most is either on the email list, which is about 1.5 million, and then the Facebook page is about 1.5 million. And there's some crossover, obviously. But on Facebook, what the nature of the community typically involves a lot of viral spreading of memes, a lot of interactions, conversation, and that can run from anywhere from instant reaction to news events to following a debate, for example, and you know, and kind of chatting in real time. But I would say today it's what you would see on the Facebook side, at least, is typically a lot of engagement around memes and memeable kinds of events. On the email side, it's typically we send them emails and kind of alert them about actions, and they're typically driven to take action, which is generally an online petition, though not always, or to donate in the case of candidates. So it tends to be those things, fairly quick things that could be done online for the most part.
Is that sort of the same category as, like, I don't know, Occupy Democrats or other Facebook groups that have a lot of members online?
I think it's similar. I mean, Occupy Democrats, they do some phenomenal work. So we definitely share a lot of their stuff. So there's some similarities there for sure. You know, a heavy focus on online and on going after the right wing crazies, which we have a bumper crop of these days, and trying to do our best to fight back. So, I'm happy to be put in that same category. They're good folks.
How did you build this community?
Well, it's actually kind of I think it's kind of a hilarious founding story. This is back in 2009. George Bush had just left the presidency. And this was when Facebook was not new, but still newish. And when you would like a page, it would say, John Hlinko likes Starbucks, or John Hlinko likes McDonald's, or PETA, or whatever. And I thought, gee, it'd be kind of amusing to have a page called Not Having George Bush as President, because then the feed would say, John Hlinko likes not having George Bush as President. And I thought, oh, isn't that rich? Isn't that ironic to have me not liking something? You know, this is back when, you know, before like millions of other folks had done the same thing. And I thought it was so clever and unique. And, you know, initially, it actually got a lot of buzz. A lot of my online progressive friends said, oh, well, that is amusing. I too, would like that in my Facebook feed. And it got to like 300,000 or 400,000 fans fairly quickly. So it was just, amusing, novel, and it grew pretty quickly. But it got me thinking, okay, well, I've got 300,000 or 400,000 people here who like not having George Bush as president, and who presumably are on the left side of the spectrum. Not all of them, but most of them probably, by virtue of identifying and affiliating with that page. I thought, well, let me send them to another page that is really more action focused. And so I chose the name Left Action because it was pretty obvious what it was, and it was available as a .com. I basically posted something on the Bush page to the effect of, if you're really interested in taking actions and continuing this, please like the Left Action Facebook page, and we'll drive you towards different actions and activist opportunities. And then in 2010, when that page had grown to a few hundred thousand people, I put up a companion website with petitions. Not a ton of content, just mostly actions we could drive them to, and then started working with partners to help them build their lists. And that's where it all started. And over the years, you know, we've worked with a whole bunch of different campaigns and organizations to help them build their list, help them raise money. You know, that's necessitated keeping our list fresh and keeping it growing. And frankly, you know, just making sure the technology is up to snuff and is working and enabling us to do what we hope to do.
Now that I have a little bit of a sense of Left Action, what I want to do is sort of get a sense of your path to that point, and then I want to talk more about Left Action. So where'd you grow up?
Sure, yeah. I grew up in a place called Valley Stream, New York, which is on Long Island, not too far from Kennedy Airport. If you've ever seen the movie Goodfellas, then you get a real sense for how I grew up. It was a very working class Italian town, many different groups, but a lot of mafia stories played out there. And growing up, I had some very, very funny friends. Actually, my best friend was a guy named Fred Armisen, who's now gone on to be on Portlandia, Saturday Night Live. He's an absolutely great guy. You know, most of my early years were spent just with really, really funny people, just kind of, bantering back and forth. And to this day, I still love that for activism, to the extent where it's applicable, is using humor. I've loved it since I was a kid.
It does feel like some of the very best coverage of politics is in the world of humor.
Oh my God, totally. I forget where I read this, but someone made the point that back during the days of the court jester was the only one who could tell the king or queen the truth. And yeah, sometimes they got their heads cut off for that, but basically everyone else would kind of bow and be all deferential. But the court jester would tell them, the truth, and usually cloaked in humor. And I think that's what a lot of what we've got going on with the news now. But at the same time that a lot of the mainstream media folks will, defer and be deferential to Trump, frankly pretend that what he is saying, that is total horse crap, is the truth, because, well, he's the president, you know, people like Trevor Noah or, you know, or any number of other folks are not afraid to call it like it is. So that's where we're getting some of the best coverage right now. Some of the best news is coming from the non-news places.
So you grew up a little bit in that tradition. Where did you go off to college?
Well, I went off to college at a place called Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Absolutely great. And it was a huge part of my development as a human, because I got to meet a lot more diverse folks and get exposed to all kinds of different points of view and really gotten more and more involved with activism. You know, up until then, I'd identified myself as a Republican. The New York of the 70s and 80s, Republicans were fairly moderate and not insane and sometimes quite liberal. But at Wesleyan, I ended up breaking with it. I got disgusted with the party, with its social conservatism, and with its homophobia, and just a whole range of other issues. And so I ended up becoming a Democrat.
That seems to have happened to a lot of people around then. Yep.
I mean, it was just, I still remember, I think it was Jerry Falwell speaking at the Republican convention, and just, I just had this epiphany that, wow, that was the sound of stupid. And I just had zero desire to affiliate with that party anymore. I consider myself moderate. I just think the country has moved in the profoundly different direction, or not the country, but the elected officials who've managed to claw and cheat their way into office in many cases.
But you studied economics and went to Lehman Brothers, right?
Exactly.
How was that?
Oh, that was, you know, it was so funny, because like when I was a senior at Wesleyan, I was like, well, what do I do now? I guess I go to law school, which I thought about and, you know, it would have been very interesting. But they came to campus, a number of investment banks and consulting firms, and I ended up getting a job at Lehman Brothers. And I really didn't know what investment banking was, to be honest. But I knew that they seemed to pay pretty well. And I got it by telling a series of jokes. At the time, I was doing a comedy show on WESU, the college radio station. So they said, well, we see that you do a comedy show. Why don't you tell us a joke? So I said to them, well, I don't really tell jokes so much as I could pull a wallet out of your ear. And I did the old like total dad joke, pull a wallet out of their ear. And then I did an imitation of Jimmy Stewart advocating for the use of crack. And they, I guess, thought it was funny. And for some reason, that translated into me being qualified to be an investment banker. And yeah, I was hired for a two-year term. It was what they call the financial analyst program, where you do it for 2 years. And it was interesting. And I was fortunate in that I was focused on international advisory work. So it was less of hardcore investment banking and more of like consulting foreign officials. I mean, I was mainly doing research, but in the context, it was interesting. But, you know, at the end of 2 years, I knew it wasn't for me. Yeah, so after Lehman Brothers, I went to the ACLU, which is not a normal transition. But I'd always been intrigued by the ACLU. I got an interview, and they had a position available for the public education coordinator for the Art Censorship Project, which I should point out was really the Artistic Freedom Project. It was not in favor of art censorship. It was working against it. And it's amazing how many calls I started that where people said, well, I disagree with you. I want artistic freedom. And I was like, no. That is what we do. So this was back when they had just done a lot of work on the NEA4 issue, people who were denied funding, artists who were, frankly, great artists.
Controversial.
Exactly, yeah. Controversial. And I just thought, well, you know, the whole point of art is just to push boundaries. Or it's not the only point, but if you just have safe art, art never advances, and we still have, you know, what we had 1,000 years ago, and it would be pretty boring. You can imagine a lot of the, quote, art that we were defending was really like edgy, adult-ish kind of stuff. And in fact, my very first media hit was in the adult video news. It was interesting. So then after that, I decided that I wanted to go to grad school, and I really thought long and hard about law school. But I decided that I enjoyed the ACLU. I really liked it, but I didn't love what I was doing, and it was nothing against them. It just was my realization that I probably wouldn't have been a great lawyer, because I just, that part of the job, as important as it is, it just wasn't what got me going. I was flying back from Europe. Well, I was sitting at across the aisle from a guy named Colin Campbell, who had been the president of Wesleyan. And I just went over and introduced myself, and we'd met back when I was a student there. Great guy. And we just ended up sitting together for a couple of hours, and he chatted with me about the Kennedy School up at Harvard. After he heard what I liked doing and where my interests were, he said, you know, you should give them a call. You should go tour. And one of the deans was a graduate of Wesleyan. And so I just went up there and I fell in love with the place. Public policy school, master's degree. It's sort of a combination of business and politics and international relations. And I, by some clerical error, I managed to get in. I just absolutely loved it.
What was the thing that you learned there that you took most forward into your career?
I ended up doing some comedy writing there. I just realized the power of comedy to make a political point, to spur activism in a limited way. But, you know, I mean, it sounds so ridiculous, but we would do, myself and a couple of other students, would do these pranks where we would leave like fake memos in the mailboxes of all the students talking about how there's, you know, as you know, there's a required swim test to graduate from Harvard, and how there's, you know, this includes a 20-minute clothes survival float and an hour-long backstroke, and just these ridiculous memos. And then when they found out it was, you know, it was a joke, they would love it and be engaged and excited. And we started, myself and a couple of other friends, started up a thing called the Kennedy School Guerrilla, this comedy magazine, which lasted for about a year. It was, you know, using humor to make political points, to spur activism. Well, not so much spur activism as just engage people. I realized that, you know, frankly, even getting into Harvard in the first place, again, in my interview, I told jokes. I took a test and I had grades and all that stuff. But, you know, I saw the power of humor again as I met with the dean and just did my Jimmy Stewart impression. And it just kept on getting driven home that even amongst the most serious, smartest people, you know, humor was a big thing. Humor engaged people. It pierced the veneer of cynicism that too often clothed and cloaked political action.
You said you were friends with Fred Armisen. Were you following his career? Was he already like on TV? Were you in touch when you were doing these sort of comedy things?
We definitely were in touch. We to this day. I mean, I don't see him as often as I'd like to, but we hung out like when we're in New York at the same time, or we'll text each other. And he's just absolutely great guy. And funny as all hell. He wasn't on TV yet. Like, he actually is a phenomenal musician and was playing in a band. And I forget which band at the time, but he was, you know, doing pretty well. But all of myself and all our friends were like, Fred, man, you should do comedy. You're freaking hilarious. And he was. He has this ability to imitate people. I've just never seen anyone like it. He ended up going down to South by Southwest and just doing these series of fake interviews where he would pretend to be a German interviewer doing this like real heavy German accent. And his dad was from Germany, so he was able to, you know, but asking absurd questions like, you know, of pop musicians, like, okay, so yeah, so you play things like, Mozart and Bach. I mean, just all these different characters. And that got some attention. Some company started doing like a web series with him. But the first time I saw him on TV, I was just hanging out with some friends and watching Saturday Night Live. And all of a sudden I see featuring Fred Armisen. And I was like, what the hell? And it turns out like 3 days earlier, he had just gotten that job, like just in a whirlwind kind of quick kind of series of, you know, good and earned happenings. So like none of the friends really knew, or hardly any of us. But, the phone tree just kind of lit up and the emails after that. And it's exciting. I mean, he's hilarious. I mean, I'm so glad for his success.
What was Net Party 96?
Oh, man, that's a blast from the past. I got a comedy writing job up in San Francisco, writing for this thing that was being done by a company called Global Network Navigator, which later became part of America Online, and was called Net Party 96. And it was about a virtual candidate who runs for president. You know, 96, there's just so much you could do on the web. And it was a very early incarnation of a sitecom, I guess, a webcast, or, you know, just a website that would follow the 96 election. And so basically my job for the better part of a year was writing jokes about the 96 campaign, and then having, like, you know, folks at America Online, or GNN as it was then, just kind of put together like graphics to go with it. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was really interesting. And, you know, I actually was able to survive and live for most of a year as a comedy writer, which is mind blowing.
And so you sort of were on your way to forming a career in marketing, comedy, politics, right? In that sort of nexus in one way or another. Can you trace how you got from there to CTSG?
Yeah, sure. NetParty 96, there was a producer, Wendy Marks, who was just an awesome person. It was around 97 or early 98, I forget exactly when. She sent me an email that was about her friends who were starting this thing called MoveOn.org. It was during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, and it started off as a simple website saying, Congress should move on, should censure the president and move on with the pressing business facing the nation. But I got this email from Wendy, and I said, wow, this sounds really cool. I'm really frustrated by this, you know, by this impeachment ongoing saga. How do I connect with your friend? So she connected me with Wes Boyd and Joan Blades, who are a couple in Berkeley, phenomenal people. They started it, and they were this really cool couple, and we just hit it off. And so I did a lot of volunteer stuff for them early on, some paid, but mostly volunteer, just some press release writing, some email writing, just some brainstorming. And I just was fascinated with what they did and watching them like use the internet. So the stuff they were using for activism was really cutting edge. But then I started at a job at a PR firm called Alexander Ogilvy, or it was called Alexander Communications. And it was a high-tech PR firm, a lot of fun, a lot of very interesting. So I kind of got a sense of the media world and how that worked, and marketing. And Pam Alexander, who founded the firm, is just absolutely phenomenal, and just this, you know, great character, and like just really great to learn from. And Holland Carney, who led The Office, is also awesome. So between that, learning how to do marketing and high-tech PR, and then learning how to use the web to spur activism, and then having this, you know, always in the back of my head, this desire to do comedy, it kind of became this unholy melange of Holinko skills that combined. The first time I really kind of combined them all in an activism effort, it was in 2001 when I did something called Students for a Drug-Free White House. This is when George W. Bush had just become president. He had a policy that said that students who did not talk about their drug pass, specifically about whether they'd had any convictions, they could be denied financial aid. And this was from a guy who was, as a candidate, had refused to talk about his own drug usage. And I thought, well, this seems a little weird. He's saying that you can't get federal funding if you don't want to talk about your drug past, and yet he's run for president without talking about his drug past. So I started Students for a Drug-Free White House at justsaybelow.com, because there were a lot of rumors that he'd used cocaine, which I make no moral judgments over, but I figured it was hypocritical. And that actually did pretty well and got some coverage, got me on Fox News. It was hilarious because Fox News then, it wasn't quite as batshit insane, but it was still clearly in the right-wing camp. But the callers who called in were like, well, they agreed with me. And they said, well, this doesn't make any sense. If you don't let the kids go to college once they've reformed themselves, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to go and deal drugs or do crimes or whatever. But it was really amusing to be on Fox as a Democrat and to not be slammed on by the callers. The first campaign, online campaign, activism campaign I did that really got, I guess, national attention was an effort to draft Wesley Clark to run for president. This was in 2003.
Before you get to that, well, since I know some of the folks that used to run CTSG, I was curious what your time there was like.
Oh my God, I skipped over CTSG. I loved CTSG. It was awesome. It was like one of my favorite places I've ever worked. I mean, Dan and Stu, and I mean, they're just so many awesome people. When I watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and it, you know, this is like 20, 30 years after it came out, I always watch it and I say, oh my God, there's like 10 people in there who ended up, you know, becoming famous stars, and this was the beginning of their career. And they, oh, he won an Oscar, she won an Oscar. Oh my God, he's in it too? I feel the way about CTSG. There were all these unbelievable people who were, I mean, not necessarily at the beginning of their career, but early and just having fun and doing great work. And so many of them have gone on to just do these mind-blowingly amazing things. And but I loved it. And I actually got that job from meeting Dan Carroll at a drug war conference. That is the conference trying to combat the drug war. And he had just started like a fun effort called John Cusack for President. And I happened to have read about it. And I went up to him and introduced myself and said, I think that's hilarious. You're doing an effort for Lloyd Dobler. And he thought it was hilarious that I knew the name of the character from Say Anything. I thought it was great. And he had heard about the Just Say Blow effort, Students for a Drug-Free White House. And we just chatted and hit it off. And so then he hired me. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, I stayed there until I started the Draft Clark effort. But I still, you know, I'm in contact with a bunch of the people, and I miss them.
What was your job there?
I'm trying to remember what the title was. Oh, whoa, of course. How could I forget? Buzz Czar. BUZZCZAR, I believe. So it was bizarre, you know, play on bizarre. But Buzz Czar, trying to come up with buzzworthy activist efforts. That is really, you know, like, what are some websites we could do that, you know, could get some attention and basically could go viral, you know, creative brainstorming and just basically some sales. You know, it was a small enough firm that you basically just kind of, if there's something needed to be done, you would just do it.
How would you describe the difference between Dan and Stu?
Dan is, he's got a creative kind of funny, goofy side that really appeals to one side of me. And Stu's got like a very, very sharp business mind that really appeals to another side of me. So I feel like they were just a great combo. They're different, but they're very complementary.
Reason I asked is because another one of their employees described them as the mom and the dad of the business.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
That felt right.
That's absolutely hilarious. I still like will like banter back and forth with Dan and Stu once in a while, and I miss those guys. That was a really fun time.
I hear that from many angles. What attracted you to General Wesley Clark?
Well, this was just to set the stage. It was 2002 when I started thinking about this, and this was post 9/11 when George W. Bush's approval ratings were like 90%, and a lot of us who thought that he was going in the wrong direction thought, well, he's going to be very, very tough to beat unless we have someone who has impeccable national security credentials and can go toe-to-toe on 9/11 issues and then, you know, eventually the Gulf War 2.0, I guess. And I saw this article about this guy. It was a list of like 30 potential Democratic presidential candidates. And I saw one of them had the first name General. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let me check this out. And I read about him and I was like, man, this guy is fascinating. He was an anti-war general who was, you know, 4 stars and was the head of NATO and just had all these incredible credentials. And then I was with a couple of buddies of mine, one of whom was a self-described socialist and one of whom was more of a conservative. We just happened to be having dinner and they had both heard of him. And this is back when his name recognition was about 10%. And they both had really, really strong positive opinions of him. And I thought, huh, what this tells me is if his name recognition is this low, he was certainly known, but he wasn't, you know, as famous as he would be after. It told me that if a self-described socialist on the one hand and me, a left of center moderate, and then a moderate conservative could all agree that he was a really intriguing candidate, that there was viral potential to a draft campaign because a lot of people could be intrigued similarly and could pass it on and help grow this. That was the theory, at least.
So how did you go about starting draftwesleyclark.com?
Well, I put up a really, really just terrible looking website. I think it was extremecampaigns.com/draftWesleyClark, and it just was really awful looking. But I put up a letter and said, hey, here's who he is. We think he's really intriguing. Here's his background. Here's his bio. If you agree with us that he should run for president, add your name to this letter. And it just started. And then I should say that was, you know, I owe the inspiration for that to Wes Boyd and Joan Blades for what they had done with Move On, which was having people sign onto a letter. In this case, the names would appear in a list. So in other words, you can go to the site, you could write a message, and then you could scroll through a whole bunch of other messages from other people and be inspired to pass it on. And it started getting attention. It started getting some media coverage. We did a radio ad that got some coverage. Then we did a TV ad with a guy named Bud Jackson, who's just absolutely incredibly talented. A TV ad guy, did it for free. I shouldn't tell people that, but he did. but he's just absolutely fantastic. And the ad just got all kinds of attention, got on all these different news shows. And then we started doing pledges. We asked people to pledge money. What would they donate if he were to run? And we called it the General Fund. And people started making pledges, and it got up to $2 million. And that got us in the New York Times and on CNN. And so basically, we were getting a lot of attention. And as people would see these stories and think, well, who is this guy? And a lot of people obviously knew him already. And so his stature kept on rising and rising. So we had meetups going in 80 cities, and then we were getting tons of media attention and donations. And it was like Beatlemania. I mean, it was crazy. People were just really into Wes Clark running.
Were you building any kind of organization? Was it just you? What was the team there for the draft movement?
It was all volunteers. I think we might have gotten some pay, but it was basically limited pay. To be honest, I don't even know if we got any pay. I'm trying to think back. I know we mainly covered debts that we'd incurred. It was me, Josh Margulies, who's my brother-in-law, who was a Republican, but was really into Clark, and he came down for a while from New York to co-lead it. You know, Bud Jackson, who I mentioned, did TV. Chris Kafinas, strategist, really, really sharp. Well, Maya Dillon is her name now. I forget. I'm spacing on her name. It was a different name then. But she was just this absolutely brilliant PR person who would just get us like the most unbelievable coverage. Local groups were popping up as well that we would give it, you know, direction to, but they were really driving it on their own for the most part. So I would say we weren't building a formal campaign structure, but we had, you know, a decent-sized list of volunteers and activists and people who were into joining a campaign. So I guess it was sort of like the way the Little Rascals build, you know, go to the town dump and build a park or something. Like it was, you know, and it's all ramshackle. That's kind of what we were. A very ramshackle campaign.
You actually moved into the official campaign. How did that transition happen? How did you come together with the actual organization?
Well, I started Draft Wesley Clark in like February of 2003 and really started kind of getting other folks on board in March or April. And then by the time August rolled around, we were like, man, this has been going on for a while, and we're all maxing out our credit cards and getting donations from people, but, you know, not huge ones. And we finally were like, geez, I hope he doesn't say he's not going to run. That'd be a real disappointment. So we sent him a fax, which tells you just how long ago this was. Somehow we had his fax number, and we just said, look, this is up to you. You got to make this decision. This is a really tough decision. We respect that, but we'd love the chance to meet with you just so we can explain, you know, the number of activists we have and the resources you'd have. And we'd been deliberately not interacting with him before that. We knew this was a tough decision, and this was going to be, he had to make it himself. And we also didn't want to be viewed as like part of the campaign, because then it would be judged in a different way, and it wouldn't have been accurate. But now we finally reached out to him, and he got back right away and said, sure, yeah, I'd love to meet. And we flew out to LA, a couple of us, and met him in a hotel, you know, in a conference area of a room. We had dinner and just chatted. And he was just such a nice guy and so interesting. And I mean, I liked him right from the get-go, because he made fun of my my suit right away. Like, he's like, John, what are you doing wearing a suit? This is L.A. And he just kind of shook my hand and smiled and winked. And I just thought, man, I like this guy. So he announced a few days later, and we got a little heads up saying, hey, I'm going to be speaking in Little Rock, or I forget if it was one of his colleagues just saying, you may want to be there. So I joined his campaign. I mean, it was technically director of internet strategy, but realistically, it was more of a grassroots outreach kind of role. There were great people, but it was, you know, it was chaotic. It was, and this is like any campaign. Like, a lot of stuff had to come together really, really quickly. And it was later than most of the other candidates had announced. And Howard Dean had already, you know, had a lot of energy behind his campaign. Rightfully so. He's a great guy. So, you know, we had a lot of making up to do, and it was a challenge. I mean, campaigns, it's basically like the ultimate startup, because it has to just kind of start on a dime and be moving at 60 miles an hour, like, you know, a second later.
What did you learn from your role in that campaign?
I learned the importance of grassroots, but properly channeled. We had a lot of grassroots energy, and I think that some of the more seasoned professional folks were wary of them, and they were wary of each other, not in a negative way, but just it was different ways of approaching a campaign. It's so hard because, you know, on the one hand, he didn't win. On the other hand, well, he came in third or fourth place out of 300 million, and that's pretty darn good. So a lot went well.
It felt like the most difficult part was that he didn't have enough practice as a candidate, as a politician, that it was a little bit of a foreign venue for him.
I think there's some fairness to that. I mean, he was a great speaker, but he was, you know, used to speaking as a four-star general and the head of NATO, and there's a way you present yourself that's just different. I saw him just, you know, catch fire, you know, pretty quickly, but it's hard when you come in, like, no matter how smart you are, and the guy is wicked smart. It's like when Michael Jordan went from basketball to briefly playing baseball, and he was doing pretty well, but still, you know, he was Michael Jordan.
And only he made double A, really.
Exactly. Yeah. The Birmingham Barons, I think. And yeah, and so I think that, you know, if General Clark had been in politics or had been able to, you know, get into the race earlier or something, who knows? You know, he is wicked smart and a great speaker. I think it is accurate that it's tough getting used to a new game and a new approach, and I think that's valid.
How did you end up working your way up through the ranks at Grassroots Enterprise, and what was that?
So Grassroots Enterprise, it was actually very fortuitous. If I remember correctly, so we definitely, for Graf Wesley Clark, once it was getting big enough that we needed to have people in the office and doing stuff, I said, well, we can't just do this out of my house. Or initially, I was doing it out of CTSG, like sharing an office with one other guy, and I was like, I can't bring five or six people in here. So I reached out to David Chu. He's now a state official in California. Great guy, smart as all hell. But we knew each other from the Kennedy School. We'd been there together. I asked if they had any space, and so they had some space that they sublet to us. And I got to know the grassroots people, Arvin Rajan, who's just great guy, smart as all hell as well. That was a really smart firm. So we were there, and they tolerated us, and which, you know, when you have like a bunch of like draft Clark people screaming at the top of their lungs because something didn't get done, or because we ordered 10,000 Clark bars to hand out on the street, and then we only got 2,000 or whatever, like they tolerated us. And then when the Clark campaign ended, I reached out to Arvind. Well, actually, he was running the firm, but there was a D.C. and San Francisco office. And I asked him, I said, hey, just out of curiosity, I'd be interested in working with you guys. And he said, yes, come talk to us and blah, blah, blah. And it just was a really good fit. So I got hired as vice president of marketing, or sales and marketing, I forget the title. And then eventually was CEO when Arvin went on to do something else. And he left. And so he asked me if I wanted to be CEO, and I said, yeah. So it was fun.
I'm always curious about people who are running firms like that. How big was it when you were running it?
Well, depends at what point. Initially, it was about 15 or 16, and then we hired some people, and we got up to like in the 20s, I think. And then the 2008 crash hit, and we started retrenching. So we had to get rid of a bunch of people, and that was a real challenge. But for a while, it was great. It was fun.
What did you learn from running a firm?
Oh, my God, a ton. I think the biggest lesson was the importance of having cash. And I don't mean just, you know, having like a zillion dollars, but would basically, when the crash hit, it was way more severe than we realized. And we've been growing and doing really well. And then all of a sudden, all these contracts got canceled. And we may be going back to those days, actually. I would have had more of a cushion.
Did the crash take the firm down?
It did. I wouldn't say it took the firm down, but it made it way more difficult and made it necessary to have a severe retrenching of the you know, the size of the firm and stuff that made all kinds of sense 6 months earlier suddenly just wasn't doable. It was a real problem because, you know, like Dr. Fauci had this point where he talked about the epidemic and Wayne Gretzky's great quote about, you don't skate to where the puck is, you skate to where the puck is going. So when you're running a firm, you have to kind of guess where the puck is going to be going. Stuff that in the early 2008 seemed to make all the sense in the world was just, it was a different universe 6 months later.
So you had talked at the beginning of the interview a little bit about Left Action. If I ask you to sort of just describe Left Action generally, why would someone want to be part of it?
Sure. The way we describe it is millions of progressives fighting back against right-wing stupidity. So if people are frustrated by the right-wing, right-wing candidates, right-wing president, then this is a place where they can go and get alerts, you know, email and Facebook updates on actions they can take quickly. And if they want to get more engaged, we can connect them with campaigns and organizations that are doing all kinds of things. And so it's an easy way to get involved with activism.
How do you keep it going? What's the sort of business model for it?
Generally, it's candidates and campaigns and organizations will come to us. Like the most typical interaction is they want to send an email to the list because they know we've got a bunch of activists. They have something they believe the folks will be interested in, you know, that they're doing, and whether it's a candidate or a specific kind of activism effort. And we figure out a reasonable price. And that helps us to keep the back end systems going and to, you know, pay for the consulting work we need to get done. So it's paid, but it's not going to make me billions of dollars, but it's good enough that it pays the bills and enables us to keep growing and going. So what we hope is that candidates and organizations get more value than they pay if they send a donation ask, that they do better than what they paid. So that's not always the case, but over time, like the idea is we want to grow these organizations and get people connected, kind of like a matchmaker in a way.
Do you have a sense of how your list compares to the other lists?
The email list, it tends to skew female. I think it's like 60%. That is the Facebook page is 63% female. There is a new organization that we've started that's a sort of a sister organization of Left Action, Woman Up, that my wife started. Lee Stringer, who is just way better than me in every conceivable way. So that is directed towards women. And for that, women progressives, for that, we've tried to kind of have a different list. We've done some comparison between those two, but I don't know if that really would tell you how it is versus, like, say, you know, more established, older lists.
How did your community respond to the rise of Trump and his election?
Liquor. Before he got elected, as it was getting to the closing days, I mean, I got to say, I was nervous. And when people would ask me, what are the odds? I would say, you know, it's not 50-50, but he's like 25 or 30%. This is not a done deal by any stretch. Just watching the polls and key states and overall and looking at the trends and hearing anecdotal evidence. So I was shocked and appalled, but not surprised. When around like 9, 10 p.m., election night, I started getting calls and texts from friends who, you know, consider me their political friend, you know, just people out of D.C. or whatever, saying, okay, you got to, this is not happening, is it? And I was like, I'm afraid it is. So, you know, once it happened, I mean, I give a huge amount of credit to the Women's March people, like the, you know, the ones who organized that first really big response, because I mean, that was huge. People needed that. People needed hope. And I think I saw stuff like that start to galvanize the left action community. I mean, initially it was just sort of a holy crap moment. What just happened? You know, we're in the Titanic and we just hit the iceberg. Wait a minute, what? This is terrible. But then someone realizes, okay, well, here's a life raft over here and here's a life raft, and there are ways to fight back. And I think I was really proud of how left action activists and activists in general on the left and the progressive and the center, how they just said, okay, well, you know, we got knocked down, now we got to get up. And people fought back. And I saw the amount of engagement, like the amount of signups go through the roof, the amount of actions, donations, and people just really rallied. And it's a tough time. And we're seeing, you know, right now the danger of putting an incompetent boob in charge. You know, people are rallying, and hopefully we'll have a change in direction in 2020.
So you've been doing this left action thing for, you know, it's like a decade now. What makes you keep going? Are you still excited and motivated by it?
Wow, you're right. It has been like a decade. Jeez. You know, there is still something like that the little kid in me just gets, you know, stunned and awed when I can send an email that goes to like 1.5 million people. Like, there was one time I was doing it on a plane, and I was just so astonished that this was even doable. And I thought back to those first days with MoveOn.org when I was, you know, helping out with them, how just blown away I was by the amount of response they can get so quickly from this relatively new thing called the World Wide Web. There's this little kid in me that was stunned and awed then and is awed again whenever I send this out and see a response, or when I post something on Facebook and see like likes and shares and realize in some small way, you know, I'm helping kind of maybe move the needle just a little bit. And that's a very powerful feeling.
Is that addictive, would you say?
I think there's some addiction to it. I know when I post something and I don't get a lot of likes or shares, I get frustrated. And then I realize, well, you know, I'm being silly. It's a way that inspires me to try and do better the next time. So it's an addiction, but hopefully a healthy one.
What do you think is the secret? What do you notice as the pattern to things that keep people engaged versus things that people let go or ignore?
Well, there's a couple of things that, with the internet at least, you know, with Facebook and with the web and with left action, typically you want to send something that they already are interested in and motivated to do something about. So in other words, it's tough to explain to someone in detailed terms why they should care about an issue and then get them to act on the issue in one fell swoop. So if you send them something they're already ticked off about and they really, really want to act on, that's what tends to do the best. Within that, it tends to be things that have a clear villain. So it's not just, the world should be a better place. It's tell Donald Trump to resign, blah, blah, blah. Like just with a real villain that they're already annoyed about and agitated about and frightened of or whatever. And then also, I think something that hits people on an emotional level rather than solely an intellectual level. Like you really need to get them, not necessarily angry. I mean, anger is part of it, but laughing and angry or surprised, but like you need to get a response, an emotional response. If it's just solely intellectual, I mean, I love a good, you know, economic treatise or something, but you know, I'm a policy geek at heart, but you know, the stuff that works is stuff that hits them in the heart as well as the head, but the heart first.
Do you think Trump has a knack in his own way for that kind of attention-seeking success?
Yeah, I think he's the worst president we've ever had, but he's got some undeniable talents. He delivers his routine, and this wasn't my observation, I forget who pointed this out, but that he delivers his routines like a stand-up comic, like little inflections and ways he says stuff that for a lot of people is very engaging, and it's very comforting to have simplistic solutions for complex problems. So when he talks about, oh, well, it's not you, it's those people over there, they're the ones who caused all the problems. It doesn't matter how many papers or stats you can point to that refute that. People like easy answers. And even if they're wrong, if they're easy to believe and they take them off the hook, they're very compelling, and those are frankly quite addictive. So he's very good at tapping into that, which is a shame for America, but he's talented, just not a good leader.
When you think about other people who have a knack online in politics, who else comes to mind? I was thinking of people like AOC.
Oh, totally.
She has a real undeniable talent too for communicating in a newer way using these tools.
I totally agree. I think for more of the national stature folks, like people who are less of the strategists and more the public figures, like AOC, there's no two ways about it. She's tapped into something that's profound and huge. She's, in spite of all kinds of right-wing slams against her, she is extraordinarily smart and very, very talented at communicating. Bernie Sanders in his way, I mean, it's different, but he's got a style that really appeals to a lot of people and frankly turns off a lot of people. There's no two ways about it. He's very good at communicating to people and, spurring, quite a reaction. But I think AOC, she's just almost, I don't want to say unique because that's not fair to a lot of other people. But, for her to do what she did, to come from just a regular job and then suddenly take out an incumbent and become one of the thought leaders of a 200-year-old party, I mean, that's kind of mind-blowing.
It is. Is there a question that I didn't ask that you wish I had?
Oh, well, my book is about 10 years old, but people could still buy it. Share, retweet, repeat. Get your message read and spread. So if people want 10-year-old advice, they can find that online and still buy the book.
What would be a key piece of advice that they would find in that book?
Well, to be honest, they probably could find a lot of what I said from listening to this podcast, but they still should buy the paper version. The key advice is when you ask me about what kind of stuff resonates, stuff that impacts, that hits people on an emotional level, stuff that is fresh in their heads that they already have an opinion about, and stuff with a villain. But also, it goes a lot into the use of humor. I think that's actually still legitimately helpful. I mean, the specifics in the book about Facebook and Twitter, they're different now. The technologies have changed, but the basic lessons of creating content that's compelling and share-worthy, that still is right on.
Well, John, it's been a real honor to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
No, thank you. And the honor is all mine. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That was John Hlinko and Left Action. John's at leftaction.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.